They were nearly caught twice, the last by inches, the four saved by a white farmer's wife who warned them at the last minute that a party with horses, dogs, and rifles awaited them nearby. They had thanked the woman profusely, and then, inexplicably, she demanded a dime.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Author James McBride came to national attention in 1996 with his searing memoir, The Color of Water. It told the story of McBride's white widowed mother, a Jewish immigrant from Poland, and it explored McBride's struggle to understand his own biracial identity. This week, we'll hear the best-selling author read from his new novel, Song Yet Sung. It's about a runaway slave who has visions of the future. McBride says when he wrote the novel, he looked at slavery as a web of relationships. Seeing it from that perspective propelled the entire book. This reading of Song Yet Sung took place in February 2007 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much. So nice to see so many white people. I mean, nice people here today. But really feel deeply moved that you're so much. Anyway, my first book was The Color of Water. Many of you read that, and we'll talk about that after you buy this book. No, we'll talk about that today. My second book was Miracle at St. Anna, which is a story of the 92nd Division, which is being filmed by us, which has just been completed as a film by Spike Lee for Disney Touchstone. That's coming out in December. We'll talk about that later, too, if you want. I wrote the screenplay for that, too. Song Yet Sung. Song Yet Sung began when I tried to write a novel before this. After I finished Miracle at St. Anna, I wanted to write about slavery. I wanted to write about the Civil War and the perspective of the Civil War from black people's perspective. So I went to Illinois and I was studying Abraham Lincoln. I was fascinated with Abraham Lincoln. I love Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he's my man. No, I mean, I was fascinated with his life and how he lived and how he approached life and his whole, and he was a giant, he was 6'4", you know, he was a great writer, you know. Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King were two really fine writers, if you read their work. And I read a Carl Sandburg book about Abe Lincoln that was just really, it was magnificent. And so I went out to Illinois, I spent a lot of time out there, I went to the libraries and historical societies and so forth. And I wrote I researched for about, I don't know, maybe a year, and then I started writing. And I couldn't get these characters to move from one room to the next. They just wouldn't move. It was, the novel just upped and died under its own weight. Thanks be to God, you know, E Pluribus Unum. Because it was a terrible book, so I gave up on it. I let it go. And then I was, I just started trolling. And I got in my trusty 1991 Volvo. And I drove down to the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And I was driving down through Cambridge. And I saw a sign that said, Harriet Tubman, you know, birthplace, 10 miles or something like that. So I followed the yellow brick road. I just went down and followed the signs until I came to this field. And in this field, there's a sign that says, Harriet Tubman, you know, Moses of her people saved, you know, rescued 300 people from slavery. And so I started, I just stood there for a while, and I just looked around, and I just kind of vibed the place a little bit. And I said, this is really kind of interesting. Then I learned, you know, that Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman lived around at the same time. And then I started driving around the Eastern Shore, and I'm sure some of you are probably from the Eastern Shore. You've seen the Eastern Shore more than I do. You know it better. But I just thought the land was a really mystical place. I mean, in the sense that, it's a beautiful place during the day, but at night, baby, it's scary. It's cold. The Chesapeake has its own life. It's, you know, it's one of those kind of places where, like, Native American people gave their names to places. I'm sure they had some very, very good names to give the Eastern Shore, because it was and is a place where you can go, you know, a mile away from Dunkin' Donuts and look around and see pretty much what it looked like 200 or 300 years ago. So I started doing some studying about the area. I spent a lot of time at the Cambridge Historical Society reading slave testimony, slave manuscripts, historical books, historical accounts. I read a lot of the great writers from the Eastern Shore. Adam Wallace's piece on his work on Joshua Thomas, who was a minister, Methodist minister, who floated around the Eastern Shore on a bungee and just spread the word of God and so forth. And I started to kind of get a picture of what slavery might have been like at that time. And as I did, these characters started to kind of arrive. Now, you know, when I used to go see, I once saw, when I was at Oberlin, I once went to see like a great writer. You know, I won't name this great writer's name, but, you know, I went to see this great writer. And like, and afterward, and she was talking, she said, well, you know, the characters, you know, they jump up, they shake my hand, they talk, they sleep with me at night. I'm saying to myself, please. I mean, yeah, right. But, and it didn't help that afterwards I went up to her and I said, you know, Miss, you know, I'm James McBride. You know, I'm a student here. I really love your work. And she was like, nah, you know. So, but it's true that after a while, you know, you start imagining these people, they start to move around a little bit. And once you just get them to pop out the desk drawer, they start to move. And then as these characters start to move, your plot starts to shape itself. So the main character of this book is named Liz Spokot. And she shares, she was inspired by Harriet Tubman, but she only shares this similarity with Miss Tubman, in that when Harriet Tubman was a child, she was struck on the head. And the rest of her life, she would fall asleep instantly. Like she would just, you know. And she would sleep for like 5 minutes, and she would wake up, and she would carry the conversation on, you know. But I have students at NYU like that, but that's another story, you know. But she would, you know, she would fall asleep, you know, and then she would wake up, and she would, and she said when she fell asleep, she often said she would dream. And these dreams would tell her which way to move, how to move the, because this woman moved, listen, there what, there are 100 people here or 70 people? If 10 of us, you know, if like 10 of us got up and started walking down whatever that street is there, you know, I don't know D.C. that well, whatever that street is, you know, we would attract attention. So how do you move 300 people, slaves, you know, and slaves were dressed like slaves. How do you move that many people back and forth? There's some magic involved. And so what I discovered was that in addition to her ability to kind of forecast or smell trouble when it was coming, that she enlisted the use and she enlisted the help of black and white watermen who worked on the Eastern Shore. Only now, at least, you know, from what I can discern, historians are still trying to figure out the many ways that Harriet Tubman moved blacks up and down the Eastern Shore. And one of the ways she moved them, and it's pretty well documented now, that is that she moved them through the water. Because there are hundreds of creeks, small creeks and rivers that flow through the Eastern Shore. And these creeks and these rivers and these swamps were peopled and trolled and known from bank to bank by watermen, white and black watermen. And watermen were men who worked on the Chesapeake trolling for trout, I mean, I forgot the word, but they tonged for oysters. And that was a mode of living. And watermen's life, the life of watermen was a very, very difficult life. But it when I took all this information and I started to, these, you know, I let these characters start to move around. And so what happens, Liz Spokot is basically has the same ability to dream as Harriet Tubman, but her dreams are of the far future. So she wakes up, because I said to myself, what would happen if a black person woke up right now from the slavery, sat up and was like sitting in the middle of a, you know, a 50 Cent concert where he's, you know, holding his balls and, yeah, bitching, hoeing, you know, what would, you know, all the struggles and, the, you know, the desire to read and learn and the moral bar that black people struggled so hard to come to terms with, to reach. What would happen if a slave just woke up now and saw how we're living? For that matter, what would happen if a white waterman woke up now and saw how white people were living, gorging themselves senselessly with food and children who run from books and so forth? So this book takes place in 1850 with about a woman named Liz Spokot who dreams of tomorrow, and her dreams are about America today, contemporary society. It begins with Liz being caught, trapped in the attic of a slave catcher, a slave stealer. There were three types of slave traders who worked at what was called the trade. There were slave catchers, whose job it was to go out and catch slaves. There were slave traders who traded slaves. And there were the slave stealers, who were the most desperate and the most ruthless of them all, because if you were walking down the street, if this young lady was walking down the street, it was basically snatch her, hide her, wait for a steamer or a dory boat to come up from the south, sell her off, make the money and go home. It didn't matter that if she was sold, it was a loss. It was all about the economy. That money was a loss. The loss of her life meant a loss of thousands of dollars to her owner, loss of, you know, loss of parent, wife, and so forth to her family. But to the slave stealer, she was money in the bank. So slave stealers basically prowled. So one of the characters in the book is named Patty Cannon, who was based on the real Patty Cannon, who actually who lived in Reliance, Maryland, right on the line of Maryland and Delaware. And the reason why her tavern was on the line between Maryland and Delaware is that when the authorities came to arrest her, she could just step in a room and they would be out of their jurisdiction. I remember one time this brother told me, he said, well, if I'm running from the police and I see Virginia, I just stop. If I'm running from D.C. to Virginia and the cops are chasing me, I just stop and let them catch me in D.C. I don't know what that says about Virginia, you know. But anyway, so Patty, this book begins with Liz Spokot finding herself trapped in the attic of Patty Cannon. On a gray morning in March 1850, a colored slave named Liz Spokot dreamed of the future, and it was not pleasant. She dreamed of Negroes driving horseless carriages on shiny rubber wheels with music booming throughout, and fat black children who smoked odd-smelling cigars and walked around with pistols in their pockets and murder in their eyes. She dreamed of Negro women appearing as flickering images in powerfully lighted boxes that could be seen in sitting rooms far distant, and colored men dressed in garish costumes like children, playing odd sporting games and bragging like drunkards, every bit of pride, decency, and morality squeezed clean out of them. Liz had this dream in captivity, just as the flickering light of her own life was disappearing, and when she awoke from it, realized with a gasp that it was some kind of apparition and she had to find its true meaning in this world before she died. This brought her more grief than her condition at the time, which was not pleasant, in that she'd been lying for 3 weeks, badly wounded, in prison, in an attic on Maryland's eastern shore. She had taken a musket ball to the head at Ewell's Creek, just west of Newmarket. It was 5 a.m. when she was hit, running full stride on a brisk March morning behind three other slave women who had made a desperate dash for freedom after 2 days of keeping a hair's breadth from two determined slave catchers who had chased them, ragged and exhausted, in a zigzag pattern through the foggy swamps and marshland that ran up from Bishop's Head Island up through Dorchester County. They were nearly caught twice, the last by inches, the four saved by a white farmer's wife who warned them at the last minute that a party with horses, dogs, and rifles awaited them nearby. They had thanked the woman profusely, and then, inexplicably, she demanded a dime. They could not produce one, and she screamed at them, the noise attracting the slave catchers who charged the front of the house while the women leaped out the back windows and sprinted for Ewell's Creek. Liz never even heard the shot, just felt a rush of air around her face, then felt the cool waters of the creek surrounding her head and working their way down her throat. She tried to rise, could not, and was hastily dragged to shallow water by the other women, who took one look at the blood gushing out near her temple and said, "Goodbye, child, you're free now." They gently laid her head on the bank of the muddy creek and ran on, the sound of barking dogs and splashing feet echoing into the empty forest, the treetops of which she could just make out as the fog lifted its hand over the dripping swamp and the sun began its long journey over the Maryland sky. Not 2 minutes later, the first dog arrived. So begins Liz's journey into the world of being a runaway slave. What happens after that is that she's caught, and when she looks up, the person who catches her is not this enraged white man who's saying, "Come home," but rather a black man who works for this slave catcher named Patty Cannon. He strikes her over the head, he takes her to this place, and she wakes up to find herself chained next to a woman who calls herself the Woman with No Name. And the Woman with No Name asks Liz, you know, "Tell me about your dreams." And so at first Liz is afraid, because in a room full of slaves, where someone would trade your life away for, you know, a piece of bread, there was no trust. So the woman says to Liz, "If you tell me your dreams, I'll tell you the code." And so Liz asks, What's the code? And so the woman begins to give her little pieces of the code. Chance is an instrument of God. The blacksmith is doing marriages these days. find the double wedding rings. When you tie a knot, tie the 5 points to the knot, and you'll always find the true. So she says all this, she speaks in code, and Liz doesn't understand what she's saying, but in giving Liz the code, it leads to a breakout, and Liz leads a breakout. These 14 slaves break free and inspire the rage of Patty Cannon, who has now lost 14 slaves who are worth thousands of dollars. And in addition, when Liz leads the breakout, she kills the man who captured her, the teenager who captured her, whose name was Little George. So basically, the rest of the book is a chase with Patty Cannon and her crew trying to catch this slave who, as Liz makes her run, she's trying to figure out what the code means. I mean, and she runs into certain people, some of whom know the code and some of whom don't. In addition, an additional character is introduced named Denwood Long, and he's a waterman. And he was one, at one time, the most fierce slave catcher in Dorchester County, meaning that plantation owners would hire this guy to catch their slaves. And what happens is Denwood Long is down on his luck. He's a drunkard now. He doesn't do that anymore. He's back on the water and so forth. He drinks a lot. His wife left him and so forth. But he takes this job for the money because the owner of Liz Spocott has offered him a lot of money to catch her. So he is known to black people. He's known to black people the way that certain cops in my old Brooklyn neighborhood used to know who we were. You know, we'd know where he was okay. You know, there was a level of sort of wary trust that exists between Denwood Long and black people. Because black people, both free and slave, know that he only does it for the money. So you could run 70 slaves by him that were running with Harriet Tubman, and he wouldn't touch them. He just wanted the one that he was getting paid to get. So the next section of the book I'll read to you is from Denwood Long is known as the Gimp. Black folks call him the Gimp because he has a wounded leg that he wounded in some fashion. We never say how he wounded it. It doesn't matter. It's fiction. But this is a conversation between Denwood Long and the blacksmith in Cambridge City. Now, blacksmiths were said to be part of the Underground Railroad as well, because what they would do is when they hammered certain tones and certain rhythms, it would give people signals as to whether you can move now, if you were high, hold. You know, this meant move, this meant hold, this meant move to the west, this meant move to the east, and so forth. So the Gimp knows all about this. And so he goes into the blacksmith shop wanting to find out about this slave that he's trying to catch. And this is the conversation between the two of them. And this is the only time, by the way, that Harriet Tubman is mentioned in this book. And she's mentioned by the name that she was known to black people as. She was known as Moses. So this is the conversation between those two. "Are you free or slave?" the Gimp asked. "Free, sir," said the blacksmith. "Then I could get you in a mite of trouble, couldn't I?" Denwood said. The blacksmith placed his hammer down. "I've done nothing wrong," he said. The Gimp looked at him. "Five hits, stop. Two taps, stop. Five hits, stop. Then a light two again. That's it, ain't it? Tell me you ain't signaling somebody, and I'll leave out right now on your word. But if I find out you're lying, I'll knock you squint-eyed and stand you up for the constable. You're working on the gospel train, ain't you?" The blacksmith stared at the floor. "You the Gimp, then?" he asked. "I am." "I heard you was about," the blacksmith said. "Can I shut the door?" "Go ahead." The blacksmith went to the door, closed it against the driving rain, locked it, then returned to his anvil. "I thought you left the trade," he said. "Got married and going back to the water. That's what I heard. Colored folks about had a party over it last year." "Well, now," Gimp said, "and nobody invited me?" You was on Hooper Island, sir," the blacksmith said. "That's a ways from here. You know how hard it is for the colored to get about." The Gimp stifled a smile. "I'm looking for one soul," the Gimp said. "Whoever else you're trafficking ain't my business." "Depends on who it is," the blacksmith responded. "It's a colored somebody," the Gimp said, "working against the trade." The blacksmith responded, "If you're talking to Moses, if you're talking about Moses, you might as well be singing to a dead hog. I'd be in a spot. Reckon I'd have to hang first. Colored round here would blister me faster than a baby can stick a thumb in his mouth. My wife, my children, they'd be dead before my feet touched the ground outside that door there. I've never seen Moses, by the way. Wouldn't know Moses by sight." "It ain't her I'm seeking," the Gimp said. The blacksmith stifled a grimace. The Gimp knew Moses was a she. The book spirals forward and introduces later on a character known as the woman. As Liz is running and hiding from these people who are trying to catch her, she mistakenly, accidentally comes across a little boy who's trapped in an animal trap, and she frees him. And this child happens to be a free child who's the son of a character known as the woman. And the woman is based on a real character. You know, and during slavery, there were slaves who just went out in the woods and stayed there and never came out and lived. And so the woman lives out in the way out on the edge of the Chesapeake Bay, on the Chesapeake Inlet there. And in helping the woman's son, Liz moves this story to another level. And so basically the chase, the rest of the book is a big long chase involving the Gimp, Patty Cannon, both of whom don't like each other, and the woman who was pulled into this mistakenly because his son had the misfortune of being caught in an animal trap. And also the woman is a character who lives way out in the woods and has been quiet. He was there since he was 5 years old. He really doesn't speak English that well. The boy's mother died many years ago. It's just the woman and his son. And he sees civilization encroaching on him. The white man is coming closer and closer and closer. So the woman kind of represents the innocence of black people. Because even though he's a wild, like almost savage-looking person, you know, with wild woolly hair, and he's big, and he's strong, he's muscular, and he moves through the forest like with the speed of, you know, like Superman, you know. He's an innocent. He doesn't really understand slavery that well. He just knows that he's always done better when he keeps away from everyone, black, white, and other. He's okay. So as his innocence is soiled, so moves the story. The title of the story comes from the code, because one of the things that Liz is seeking is something that's said early on in the book. And the woman with no name says to her, "You can find freedom when you find the song yet sung." So that's where the title of the book comes from. Regarding the woman character, the reason why I created that character, because when you get to the middle of a narrative like this, it's already spinning along pretty good. There's no need to disturb it. It was because, you know, like James Baldwin once said, you know, it's a hell of a thing at the age of six to realize in a world of cowboys and Indians that you're the Indian. You know, even though the book sort of makes a critique about some elements of hip-hop culture, it's very hard as a parent to see my, you know, once six-year-old son grow into a 14-year-old who is now tall and who people cross the street when they see him come in, and suddenly he's no longer my little boy who reads Superman comics and, you know, goes, you know, like Spider-Man. He becomes a suspect in society. You know, white people think you make racism up. But when you're a parent of a child of color, be it black or Latino, it's a whole different world. Your whole mentality changes. And so I wanted that whole business of this child, this man's innocence, to be soiled by societal's view of him. In addition, I thought it was important to deal with a character like Denwood Long, who is an ambiguous. This book is filled with ambiguity. Good people do bad things. Bad people do good things. Denwood Long is a slave catcher who is reluctantly taking on a job. He doesn't really want the job. He needs the money. He doesn't like black people that much, but he doesn't hate them. He doesn't understand why they should be so religious. He doesn't understand why someone would want to be free. Free to be what? To be like the plantation owners who are ruining his land and his water. So, I mean, there's a whole lot of ambiguity. Even Patty Cannon, who is a ruthless person, is someone who's kind of likable. So as a writer, for me, it was hard. I had to divorce myself from the brutality of slavery to kind of deal with these characters. But I felt that it was important to show people as I believe they really were, as opposed to like the stereotypical view of slavery where, you know, oh, Lord, you know, but whap, you know, I mean, you know, the guy tied to a tree. So, I mean, there was some of that, of course, but slavery really was a web of relationships, you know. Most white people didn't own slaves, and those that did own three or four, and if they were forced to sell one or sold one, they were selling off a member of what they considered to be their family, in addition to causing enormous social and psychological damage to the ones that were left. And so this web of relationships still exists now. It exists in a different way. But I think seeing slavery from that perspective is what kind of propelled this book along. And also, I love Wild West stories, you know. I love it when, you know, cowboys, and then, you know, Jesse James. I mean, although Jesse James was a slave owner, let's be real. But, and, you know, the mythology of the Wild West only lasted 20 years. And yet, it, you know, it's propelled a whole industry. Slavery, for a storyteller like myself, is an area that's rife for, you know, for storytelling. Because who knew who was good? Who, you know, there were whites and blacks who were for slavery. There were some blacks who were actually for slavery, believe it or not. There, you know, who could you trust when you were running away? And why? And how much could you trust them? I mean, it's sort of like, you know, it's like the cop who shoots a black kid on Thursday, and then someone that says, well, on Monday, you know, he rescued, you know, he got my cat out the tree. You know, good people do bad things, and bad people do good things. I'm sure there's a book with that title somewhere. And with that in mind, let's open the floor to some questions and comments, and then we can get to some other things that you want to, you know, editorials. Well, I mean, I have to like the characters a little bit to write about them in a way that is kind of objective. I mean, personally, I can't stand what she is and what she represents, but I have to like them a little bit in order to do that. I have to kind of divorce myself from, you know, she's a ruthless character, but she is also an interesting character, you know, and you have to make your antagonist interesting. I mean, that's why Darth Vader was such an interesting character. You know, Luke, you know, he was interesting. I mean, he was bad, but he was interesting. And in order for a book to be believable, your characters have to be, I think, have to be interesting.
Do you consider yourself a storyteller with a good sense of history or a historian that tells a good story?
Do I consider myself a storyteller with a good sense of history or a historian who's a storyteller? I am definitely the former. I am not a historian. I mean, historians, you know, I studied music in school. I wish I had studied history. I love history, but I'm not a historian. One of the problems as a storyteller, as a professional storyteller with history is that, or her story, you know, her story, is that you really don't know. Look, we all saw Katrina on television. And even as we watched it, people had different views about what was happening. You know, we don't know. I mean, the government's like, well, I don't know. I can't see my shoe. I got to tie my shoe first. I mean, people are drowning, you know, and they're just, you know, smoke machine. They're just blowing out. You're just talking cake and potato chips and icing. You know, people are drowning and screaming for help. And, well, I don't, what's my, is my shirt? You know, they didn't, because people see what they want to see. I mean, you could hold the story up to, and they can just, people just, I don't get it. What are you talking, you know, why? I don't get it. So, for me, I have to read history and glean from it what I think might have happened. I mean, my daughter had to read, for example, she had to read Gone with the Wind as for honors, you know, for her honors English class. I mean, I didn't say anything about it. I mean, how do you tell a 14-year-old black kid when she reads, you know, Gone with the Wind where, you know, black people basically, you know, goobers and raisinettes, more or less, you know. So you have to glean from history and then create what you think really, really happened or really could have happened. And the other thing is that, you know, you have to forgive the past. And, you know, I think only now am I at the age where I'm forgiving the past enough to kind of just say, you know what, slavery was there. Let's talk about it in ways that will help us face tomorrow. If it has to be in the kind of like an adventure, whatever, then fine. Because most people don't read history books. I'm sure people here read history books. I mean, y'all are all really smart, every single one of you. I mean, all of, even the people in the back. I mean, but, you know, normally, normal Americans, you know, I mean, not y'all are not normal. Y'all are abnormal because you read books. But, you know, like people that are walking down the street who are watching American Idol, oh, but you guys don't do that. But, I mean, no, the mythology becomes history in America. That's what it is. That's part of the reason why stereotypes are so strong here. That's part of the reason why, you know, when you look at, you know, when I see football players scoring touchdowns, doing the boogie joogie, and, you know, doing all this bullshit, it just makes me so mad. I mean, whatever you want to say about Muhammad Ali, how many of these athletes now would say, I feel this so strong about this war in Iraq that I'm not gonna play any football for 2 years. I'm not kiss my ass. I'm going to march against the war for 2 years. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to not get the $20 million. How many of the, Michael Jordan, from right on down, how many athletes would do that? The only guy that you can really say who did something like that was the guy who died, Patrick Tillman. He's the only guy. He said, the hell with it. I'm fighting for America. And you saw how they treated him after he died. It's a disgrace. It covered up his death and all this other bullshit. That's just disgraceful. So, you know, I see these guys, you know, who are, you know, scoring touchdowns. You know, I say to myself, my son's 6 feet tall, and I don't want him to play basketball. The coach, you know, he's 14 years, 6 feet tall. He's got hands like, you know, he's got a wingspan of, you know, he can touch both walls. He wears a size 12 shoe. I don't want him to play basketball. I want him to think with his head. We have enough basketball players who are black. You know, let's forget all that. Let's move on. So part of one of the business of Liz dreaming of tomorrow is it's heartbreaking to see how we've allowed ourselves and allowed our children to be treated. And this is not just something that's just, you know, blacks don't have a monopoly on hip-hop culture affecting their children's lives, you know. You know, white folks have integrated into the burning house of hip-hop culture as well. That's not to say I'm against it, but I'm against the negative aspects of it. I mean, there are some really wonderful, you know, Saul Williams and Nas and Common. These guys are really gifted people. But some of it is very destructive. This book isn't about an attack on that, by the way. Well, you said it all. I mean, that's true. I sold Color of Water sold 2 million books. And Miracle at St. Anna, you know, came out right on the heels of Color of Water and sold, you know, something like, well, I guess it's up to almost 100,000 now. That's a big difference. And it was a great disappointment to me that no one really paid. And that book went through every major director's hands in Hollywood. And a lot of black people, too, a lot of black actors as well, who have juice. And all of them turned it down, didn't even look at it twice. 4 years after the book came out, I was driving down the street. Miracle at St. Anna is about the 92nd Division. During World War II, 1 million black people served in the Army, served as part of the military forces that helped, you know, stop Adolf Hitler. Many of them, in fact, lived here in D.C. In fact, I interviewed many of them, Captain Harold Montgomery, who recently passed away. Several of the sources for Miracle at St. Anna came right from here in Washington, D.C. So my Uncle Henry, when I was a little boy, used to laugh like this. He'd go, you know, because he'd drink that joy juice, you know. And so, you know, when I was a little kid, my mother would take us to his house. Uncle Henry, my father, had a brownstone right on Carlton Avenue. I'll just tell you the story. And my mother used to take us over there and just leave us. And Uncle Henry and my father and my Uncle Walter and their friends, like people whose name like Jazz and Missouri, and they'd sit around and play poker or bid whist, you know. And they'd play it till all morning, you know, late. And then they would get drunk drinking the J&B and the Rheingold and so forth. And then invariably after Uncle Henry would get drunk, he'd say, boy, when I was in the war, the Italians, they loved us over there. We was kings over there, son. And we'd be like this, you know, here comes another story. And I never paid any attention to it. When I got older, you know, I started seeing Easy Company and all these stories and about World War II that, as you know, once again, black people were like completely invisible. And I remembered Uncle Henry talking about serving in World War II. So I did some research, and I had several. My father's best friend, who was from South Carolina, he was in the 92nd. And I started meeting all these people. I just met one. They turned me on to the other. So I created this narrative. And Miracle at St. Anna is a novel based on a true story. It's about a black soldier in World War II, a sharecropper. 40% of the 92nd Division was sharecroppers. They were the grandchildren of slaves. A big, big black guy finds this little kid in Italy, and he pulls him out of a burning barn during a firefight, and he runs in the wrong direction. And so three other black soldiers run after him, and the four of them find themselves trapped in this Italian village who they have never seen a black person before in their lives. And so And as they're trapped in this village, the German army is approaching and so forth. And the book is really wrapped around a real tragedy that happened at a place called St. Anna di Stazzema, a place where the Germans rounded up 560 Italian civilians and just killed all of them. So I moved to Italy to research that book. I lived there for 6 months. I moved there with my wife and kids. I studied Italian, you know. Can't speak a word of it, but I did study it. I studied at the New School for 2 semesters. They got all that $700 both times. I can't speak. Buongiorno is about as good as I. But anyway, so I wrote the book. You know, I thought it was going to be a great success. It just bombed. Well, a couple years ago, about 3 years ago, I was driving down the street, and my cell phone rang, and Spike Lee was, he said, "This is Spike Lee." And I said, "Damon?" I said, "Damon, you better stop that, man, all right?" And he said, "What? What?" I said, "Damon." He said, "No, this is really Spike Lee, man." And he said, "And I love that book." And I thought he was going to say, you know, because this is what they say, "I love The Color of War." And I was waiting for him to say, "I love the." And he said, "I love Miracle at St. Anna." And I was, "What?" And he said, "I'm going to make a movie of it and blah, blah, blah. So let's meet." So we met. He came to my office. I have a little office on 43rd Street that I share with this guy who fixes saxophones, you know. So Spike came by, you know. By himself, you know, doorbell. Spike Lee himself, he walks up, you know. And, you know, these cats up there getting their horns fixed. They're like, "Hey, what's up, man? Oh, hey." So he came in and we started talking. We met three times. What he wanted to do was he wanted me to write the screenplay on spec, meaning that I'd write the screenplay and then he'd sell it. Well, after, you know, I'd worked with Quincy Jones for 3 years before that. And after working with Quincy Jones, and we had contracts out there. Quincy Jones scorched my butt so it was so hot and red that you could cook grits on it. So I said, "Now I'm not working without a contract. I don't care who you are. Jesus could come up in here, and he's got the sign." And so I basically walked away from it. And a year passed, and then about a year later, Spike called me again. And he said, "You know, I'm telling you, I really want to make a movie of that book." And then he sent me Inside Man, which he had done in the meantime, and he sent me When the Levees Broke. And I saw Inside Man, which I thought was a really good movie. But then when I saw When the Levees Broke, that just, you know, for those of you who have not seen it, there's a scene in there where this lady is describing a young woman, really pretty black woman. She starts out saying, "My name is such and so. And my daughter drowned during," and she breaks down, she starts to cry. It's just, and I was sitting on the bus when I had one of these little things, you know, that you can see the movie, and I just started to cry. I couldn't handle it. And I said to myself, and Will is a journalist and an author. As a journalist, you know, you have to get people to trust you. And if she trusted him that much to give him her most private moments, then certainly I could trust him in a deal where he said he was going to make his word. And so we did it on spec. And everything he said he was going to do, he did. His word was good as gold. We wrote the whole thing. We had a handshake agreement. We worked on it for a year. No money was, he didn't have the money to pay me. We just wrote it. I wrote it and I gave it to him. We went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And finally the script was done. He had to go to Italy to get financing for the movie. And he got the movie financed in Europe. And then he brought the whole movie back that he made the movie he wanted to make. And he's editing it now, and it's coming out in November. And it's really, really good. It's starring Derek Luke, you know, the guy from Antoine Fisher. And supposedly we're going to have a showing here down in D.C., a special showing for the 92nd. At, you know, we're hooking it up through a state rep named Jolene Ivey, who's a daughter of one of the 92nd veterans. So that's what happened. And he's really a man of great principle. The irony is that I was 10 years old when Uncle Henry used to holler about, you know, I didn't know that four blocks away, the other 10-year-old that was living there was Spike. Because, you know, we lived in the same neighborhood. So God is good, and, you know. So that's what happened there. And I'm delighted that, you know, that we have the opportunity to thank some of the people who served in the 92nd. And it should be said that one of my main sources for the book was a guy named William McCaffrey, who was the father of Barry McCaffrey. And William McCaffrey was a special man. When he died, because he was the third in command, of he was the chief of staff of the 92nd Division. And he was, when he died, this is how much respect the black soldiers have, because they really didn't respect their command. Most of the commanders were from the South. Most had this, you know, the basic prejudice that you would have if you grew up in the South in the 1930s and 40s. But when General McCaffrey died, there were several members of the 92nd Division that were at his grave, you know, giving him the final salute. He was a profoundly caring person, really, really quite deep. I really was quite fond of him. Oh, okay. The question is, do Liz's dreams connect us as white and black people? That's essentially, I'm just boiling your question down. Yes, very much so. Very much so. Because Liz's dreams, her dreams of the future aren't all about hip-hop culture. She dreams, for example, of white kids, you know, rejoicing at being called nigger. She dreams of white kids crying at the pain of black people, which back then was unbelievable, I guess. So she dreams not just of the future of the quote-unquote colored race, but she dreams about the future of America where a black man will stand up and talk and thousands of whites and blacks will hold hands and be together and talk together. And, you know, she dreams of that. It's happening. Barack Obama is going to be the next president of the United States. Anyway, yes, ma'am. No, the question was, is there a movie coming for The Color of Water? The answer is no. I don't think there'll ever be a movie of The Color of Water. First of all, my mother's still alive. She's 86, kicking butt, you know. The Color of Water was optioned 3 times. And every time it was optioned, you know. The problem with The Color of Water when it gets optioned is that people have these ideas about what Jews are and how what do you know? And, you know, these, you know, I mean, you get into religious. You know, I used to work out at a gym on 9th Street in Brooklyn. And one day when David Dinkins became mayor, there was a guy who used to come in the same time as me. He was a Lubavitch guy. You know what a Lubavitch is? Well, for those of you who don't, you know, Lubavitch is a sect of Jews that live in Brooklyn. They're normal people. You know, he worked out, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so I used to see him all the time. And he would just, when I see him, he'd just nod, you know. Okay. You know, he didn't bother me. I didn't bother him. So when David Dinkins was elected mayor, me and this Lubavitch guy, we used to dress on this row. And on the other side, you know, the regular, you know, whatever, white guys would dress on that side. So when David Dinkins became mayor, you know, they didn't see us on this side dressing. And these guys started yakking, you know, Dunkin' Donuts, Dinkins, Dunkin'. You know, they was just going into. And this guy, and I was watching this Jewish guy, and he was just listening. And he was putting on his little vest, you know, yarmulke, straightening out his beard. And then when they left, he turned to me and he said, this is all he said. He said, religion and politics, shh. So that's really what happened with The Color of Water. When you start taking this religious story, politics, and the rabbi, you know, molests his daughter, and, you know, da-da-da, and black people, and get married, and what are we going to show, the bedroom scenes? And then, you know, it's like, it's not like I'm objective, you know. They're telling me what, you know, that, you know, their first screenplay had, like, you know, had, you know, my father saying, you know, honey, you got to, you know, making just I'm past the point where I have to, like, explain my life to some, you know, 30-year-old producer who just jumped out the jacuzzi, you know. Really, kiss my ass, man. I don't need it. I'd rather people just use their imagination. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, for me, I mean, I'm proud of my Jewish history. I'm proud. I have Jewish cousins now. I have a cousin named Ken who, you know, who lives in Texas. And I, you know, every time I see him, I say, man, how could you live down there? He says, it's okay. We're all in the same neighborhood. You know, it's like 3 blocks of us, you know. But for me, I mean, but for me, I'm proud. I've always been embraced by black America. I think one thing that most people don't really realize about black folks is that black folks are really warm people. It really hurts me to see how society sees us, and to some degree, how we accept a societal view of us. Television has done enormous damage to the psyche of black people, so that you have young people who think that it's not good to be kind. You got to be hip. You got to drink Sprite. You got to sit on stoops, and you know, I'm convinced that television is producing its own culture, and so I don't want to contribute to that. I don't think The Color of Water would survive very long as a movie. Let people use their imagination. You know, I just don't. You know, Alicia Keys called me like about, I don't know, a couple months ago. You know, she really wanted to do the book as a movie and blah blah blah. You know, and she's a pretty good singer, but man, I ain't giving my life story over to Alicia Keys. You know, you can forget that. You know, I just don't think. I don't want it to be a movie. I just want it to be. Let people read it and use their imagination, you know. That's a little bit dignity. Of course, now if the price keeps going up, you know, I'll be there next year, I'll be like, this was Steven Spielberg's a great guy. No, I'm fortunate to. I'm one of the few people who's fortunate enough, at least right now, thanks be to God, I don't have to worry about that, you know, so. Why did I use some historical characters and then mix them with the fictional ones? I don't really know. I thought Patty Cannon was. I don't think I could create her on my own. I didn't think I could really. You know, she's so interesting and so diabolical and so fascinating. I didn't feel I could really. I felt like I was doing injustice to history by not naming her. I mean, the feelings of this young lady aside, I mean, I'm sure it's hard for black people to read about it, but. She was not, you know, she was not unlike a lot of people during that time where they felt that black people were, you know, were less than human. I mean, part of the problem is that we humanize in our society the things that we think are precious. Like when you go see The Green Mile, you know, it's a great movie, blah, 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 and then when the mouse dies, people are crying, you know, oh, the mouse is dead, you know. Whereas in Darfur, I'll never forget when that Chinese, they had a Chinese tanker that sunk off the coast of Vancouver. And all of these Chinese immigrants or would-be immigrants were staggering, trying to get to shore. They're all trying to get to shore, and they you know, they pull these people and so forth. And then they found a dog on the boat, and they got like 20 calls for people wanting to adopt the damn dog. I mean, you know, God will forgive me for saying this, but I don't think animals go to heaven. I'm not sure. I mean, maybe Leona Helmsley's dog would go to heaven, but. My dog's just going wherever dogs go. Anyway, so I just wanted to humanize, you know, certain elements. Denwood Long, for example, is a composite of Waterman who had various feelings about slavery. You have to look at it from his perspective, too. I mean, and from the perspective of most white people, in that we are all victims of racism. But white people don't think that way about themselves. They just say, well, this is cool. I don't have to worry about it. Well, back then it was much more in your face because you had to, as a waterman, you had to compete with black watermen who weren't getting paid, for example. Or you were paired with, your life was dependent on a black waterman who was a slave. And so then you had to make sure that you took care of business because you know when you got out on the bay that his life and your life were as one. And so it was easier to do a composite of him than to do Patty Cannon. I needed that really ruthless antagonist with some character. And she just seemed ready. She just seemed made for, she's, you know, she was like made for TV, you know what I mean? So that's why. Yes, ma'am?
Could you say a little bit about your writing process, how you go about
it? I wake up at 4:30 in the morning. I usually get on a bus at 5:30. I get to my office by 7, and then I write till noon. And then I quit. Then I monkey around, you know. I do whatever. I smoke a cigarette, whatever. Then by 3 o'clock, it's time to think about getting the bus home, or I just stay the night. And then the next day, I wake up at 4:30, monkey around, and it doesn't matter whether I'm on a bus or not. I still don't start writing until 7. But if I'm researching, I just research. I don't write at all. I'll just research and research and research until I can become conversant in the subject, and then I'll sit down and start to write. But the mistake that I used to make in the past was I'd research a month or so, and then I'd start writing, and then I'd run out of fuel. You know, you have to pack that muzzle full, you know. So I just research, and then, you know, then I let loose.
Where do you draw the line with them still being human, ambiguously human, and yet being consistent?
The question is, where do I draw the line with characters being ambiguously human and yet being consistent to what they are? I don't. The more ambiguity, the better. Because people are shoved. I mean, you know, I'm assuming most of us have been, you know, sensible about the Iraq War, for example. You know, none of us are marching for it at this moment, you know. I don't know how many of us can say, yesterday I sent $100 to, you know, stop the genocide in Darfur, yet we're against it. There's an ambiguity that exists in all of us. The more ambiguity you can put in characters, the more real they are, because all of us want to do. The thing about Americans is Americans really try to do the right thing. I mean, like, you don't see Great Britain. You don't see them floating up their black people to be president, or Peru or Brazil. And they got plenty. They had slaves. Americans really try to do the right thing. And because we're a very young country, we're basically revolutionaries. We're a very young nation. And so because we're a young nation, we don't have this long history to draw from. It's almost the reason why I think that I'm almost convinced that there'll be a black president before there'll be a Jewish president. because you know, anti-Semitism is centuries old. Our racism here, just American racism, is just as old as this country. And that doesn't mean that there wasn't racism before that. But you know, you had Africa was built. Africa had kingdoms. There was an entire world there. Whereas anti-Semitism is really much deeper and much. I mean, maybe not here in this room, but when you go out to the west part of America and to the South and areas that I've been to, and when people think there are no Jews in the room, there's a deep-seated sense of anti-Semitism in America. I mean, when Gore, you know, when he brought old mop face, what's that fella's name? Joe Friedman, whatever his name? Lieberman. Man, I knew he was dead duck, man. First of all, Lieberman had no, I mean, he was, you know, not the most likable guy, you know, and not the most likable dude in the world, really. His politics, I disagree, but also the fact that he was Jewish, forget it, man. That wasn't going to work. But that being said, in terms of your answer, I think that the more ambiguous a character is, the more believable he or she is. Thank you very much, and God bless you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.